Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Wednesday, the 3rd of June, this hour of the program, bankrupt GM has now followed Chrysler into government-sponsored restructuring. There are some hopes that are being kept alive that Wisconsin factories will not close for good. We'll look at the latest status there. But, of course, a number of people have been losing their jobs. The president said yesterday that he feels good about GM's future. They are running a new ad, a new image, leaner, greener, faster, and smarter. And we'll look at what all of this means for those who have been working in the auto industry, for GM and for Chrysler and for the American public. Michael Moore, who you know did Roger and Me some 20 years ago now, which is hard to believe, was speaking yesterday from Flint, Michigan, and he believes that the president should now tell the nation we have to convert our auto factories to factories that build mass transit vehicles and alternative energy devices. And we'll talk about that idea and others. We have two guests with us, the first joining us for the first few minutes of the program and the other guest for the whole hour. Todd Lassa is with us. Todd is the Detroit editor of Motor Trend magazine, and he has been reporting on and analyzing the auto business for 13 years. He edits and writes much of the news in the magazine's trends section, and he also does the magazine's annual Car of the Year, Truck of the Year, Sport Utility of the Year, and posts on the industry for MotorTrend.com as the Motor City blogman. Todd, thank you very much for being with us again.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you. Also joining us for a minute or for a few minutes at the top of the show here is Jim Glass, who's vice president of the UAW Local 95 in Janesville, Wisconsin.
328.
And we don't seem to have him on the line.
Please hang up.
Yeah, please hang up and try again. So we'll have to hang up and try again. So we'll start with you, Todd, after, and then we'll look at Wisconsin ramifications for all of this. You know, my first thought when I hear all of this news are all of these people who are out of work all over the country and then related industries. It's really a sad day for people, isn't it?
Oh, well, it is. And the problem is we've had too much auto building capacity in this country. Even when the auto business, even when we were selling 17, 18 million cars and trucks per year in the United States, the capacity was about 23 million. And so to streamline those operations, General Motors especially, and Chrysler, and also Ford Motor Company, which, you know, is not, as we all know, is not taking government aid or a bailout, have all really cut back on employment, blue-collar, white-collar, cutting dealerships. The business is really shrinking quite quickly because we now have something like a 10 million car year this year.
Mm. So when we mean a smaller, leaner, greener for a place like GM, what are we looking at?
Well, for the first thing, for me being kind of a car guy here on this discussion this morning, is that we go from 8 General Motors divisions down to 4, which really should have happened at least a decade or so ago. Actually, wouldn't have had to happen had Roger Smith, you'd mentioned Michael Moore earlier, and of course, Roger and Me was about the CEO, Roger Smith, the CEO of General Motors in the 1980s. He added the Saturn brand to the GM stable, and then later, while General Motors was killing Oldsmobile, it was adding Hummer. So getting that down to 4 brands, Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, and Cadillac, is the first smart thing to do. And secondly, of course, a lot of cuts in both blue-collar and white-collar employment, and shrinking the number of dealers. The number of dealers that Chrysler and General Motors have announced will be cut just in the next year or so. Total more than the number of dealers that Toyota and Lexus have in this country.
Oh, my gosh.
That shows you how they had too many dealerships. And, of course, part of that is that, if you go into rural areas in Wisconsin, for example, if you go into some of the small towns, you'll see General Motors or Ford or Chrysler dealers where there are not Toyota dealers. So there should be more General Motors, GM or Ford dealers in places like in the country, because Toyota, for example, doesn't serve small-town USA the way that the domestic manufacturers do. But there are still way too many dealerships today on Capitol Hill. Jim Press of Chrysler and Fritz Henderson, the new CEO of General Motors are going to testify and talk about how they are cutting dealerships across the nation. And of course, that's a huge kind of base of employment in this country too. But we've got too many dealers. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. We do have Jim Glass, Vice President of the UAW Local 95 in Janesville, with us for a few minutes here at the top of the show. I think we've reestablished connection. Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for being with us.
How are you?
Probably better than you, huh?
Yeah. It's been a rough last year. It was a year ago today, actually, my birthday, that they announced Janesville being closed. So it's been a rough year for the people around here.
I'm sure. And on your birthday, no less.
Yeah, it was.
Fine. How do you do?
A Black Tuesday last year.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, are there some encouraging signs that something might still be happening in Janesville? And if so, what?
Yeah, actually, it's been very encouraging. You know, we don't want to get people's hopes up too much, but it's been good news in a bad news economy in a local area that we have a fighting chance thanks to our local agreement and the coalition and everybody's hard work by local officials and our governor.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope will happen?
I hope we get a product. We'll build anything GM wants to give us. I mean, I don't care if it's a battery, go back to the tractor days, whatever it may be, whatever the people want, we'll build.
Mm-hmm. What do the people want, do you think?
Well, they want a vehicle that sells, so we got some steady employment.
Right.
So we need something that the American people want to buy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you were building things that the American people didn't want to buy?
No. I mean, that vehicle that we built the last, since 91, 92, there was never more of a demand, I think, for any vehicle that GM's ever come up with. And we helped, our local people actually helped develop the Tahoe and the Yukon, the four-door that you see all over the roads today. So, no, I don't think that's ever been an issue. Except we overexpanded as a company and put it on in Texas, and then they started building it in Mexico, and then gas went up to $4 a gallon, and it killed us. But no, people wanted that vehicle and still do today.
Yeah, Todd, what do you think people want?
Well, I think Jim's right. I think during the late 1990s and throughout the earlier part of this decade, there was a huge boom in sports utility vehicles. And at that time, people were buying, you know, body-on-frame, what we call truck-based sport utility vehicles. General Motors expanded the lineup based on the Chevy Suburban, which had been kind of a low-volume, almost a specialty kind of vehicle that would you'd be able to pull trailers, for example, haul a lot of people, and it expanded that to include the Tahoe, which was a little bit smaller. There was a Cadillac version, and it still is, of course. But, you know, everybody was getting into that, including Toyota, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. The market quickly changed just in the last few years, and especially last year. It was also a year ago when gasoline was about to hit $4
right.
per gallon. And that caused the first wave of effect on the U.S. auto industry. And then, of course, a few months later, we had the credit crisis, which killed off all car sales, everything from the Prius to the Tahoe and Suburban.
Mm-hmm. And how will it be decided? When do you expect some news? Let me ask this of Jim first, and I'd like your comment, too, about what will happen. What plants are in consideration for something different, though we know not what it is at this point, and who's going to make that decision?
Well, right now, from what we understand, it's between us and Lake Orion and Spring Hill. And I think if Fritz Henderson and his team want to really show that they want a new GM with the contract we gave them back here in September, they can use this local agreement, which is actually the new national agreement that we just ratified, and they added a few things onto it. And say, hey, you know, this is what the people in Janesville did. This is why they're getting a new product. And, you know, if you want to be part of the new GM, this is what, you know, you guys should go to like Janesville did.
So mm-hmm.
I really believe that if GM wants to honestly be the new GM and do things right, they'll give Janesville products. So.
And tell me more about that contract. What makes it a good one?
Well, we made so many drastic changes at a time when other plants weren't even considering it. I mean, we lowered our trades. We probably had 13 different classifications in Janesville of different trades, so it was hard when stuff broke down to get the right people there. And now under this new agreement, you're down to 3 trades, and we're actually down to 2. And people will be well-trained in those 2 trades where when and if there is a breakdown or something needs to be fixed, you know, a small group of people can come out and get it done right away with minimum downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we talked about the swing shifts, so everybody's just working 40 hours and there's no overtime. And we had the Aramark company come in to do all our maintenance and or our sweeping and cleaning and stuff like that. And the TCs, the team coordinators, they cleaned up the areas that they worked in, and the people helped clean up and stuff like that. So we took a lot of the non-production help out of the picture and just had the people on the line making the money that were doing the work.
What do you think the chances are that Janesville will be getting a break here, Todd? How will it be decided? Who will decide what's going to happen?
That's a very good question. First of all, we know or we're pretty sure that the cars that would come to one of these 3 factories will be the new Chevy Viva. This would be about the 2011 or 2012 model year. The Viva would be a replacement for the Chevy Aveo, and it would compete with the Ford Fiesta, which is launching pretty soon, and also the Honda Fit. It's that size car. And also a small MPV with multi-purpose vehicle, kind of blend between a minivan and a sport utility, if you will, crossover utility, called the Chevy Orlando. Now, again, we've got 3 factories vying for the job. There's, you know, one interesting bit of politics here in that Spring Hill, Tennessee, first of all, was built to launch the Saturn brand back in the early 1990s. Secondly, that also happens to be the state from which Senator Bob Corker, the Republican who opposed any kind of aid to General Motors and then also said that he thought that Chrysler and General Motors should combine instead, which would have been a ridiculously bad idea, is from that state. So it'll be interesting to see whether any politics play into that matter.
Oh, I think it might, don't
you? Yeah, well, yeah.
I think so, too. What about politics here in Wisconsin, Jim?
Well, I think he made a good point. You know, I mean, as far as anybody watching those Senate hearing committees between the senator from Tennessee and another friend of his from Alabama, Shelby, you know, they just treated them guys about as un-American, I think, as you possibly could. I mean, we never saw the bank CEOs get treated like that. We never saw anybody get treated like that. And, you know, they gave so many tax breaks and so many tax incentives to the foreign companies that came into their states and did everything in their power at that time to recruit those foreign companies to produce jobs in their states, and then to turn around and just say the total opposite when it came time for General Motors, you know, that really bothered me as an American.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, do you have time to take a couple phone calls, Jim, or you have to go somewhere right away?
No, I'm okay.
All right, we'll take a pause here in a moment and then have you take a few phone calls for people who want to talk about the Wisconsin situation. Let me ask both of you, though, as we were mentioning Michael Moore, who we have to mention because of his film and his comments. I was listening to him last night talking about Flint, Michigan. He is talking about a whole restructuring. He referenced GM halting car production many years ago before the war and using assembly lines to build planes, tanks, machine guns. The conversion took time, but it was a war effort, and it was done in a hurry, actually. The president, he says, must now tell the nation we have to convert our auto factories to factories that will build mass transit vehicles and alternative energy devices, use that money to keep the current workforce and most of those who have been laid off employed so they can build the new modes of 21st century transportation. Is that even on the table? Two questions. Would you consider that as something the plant could do in Janesville, Jim? And Todd, is that just a crazy idea that we're not ready to make that kind of transformation?
Well, you know, this is Michael Moore being a gadfly and a bit of a demagogue. And, you know, we're not, car production is not going to go away entirely. There's still big demand for cars in this country. 10 million per year is a very small number historically, but, you know, people are still buying GM cars. And General Motors also is moving into battery production, into plug-in hybrid or extended-range hybrid production with the Chevy Volt to be built here in Michigan. And so there's some of that change going on already. It would take a long, long time for General Motors to convert to something like that. That said, I think there may be room for, I think, GM and maybe Chrysler and maybe even Ford ought to consider some mass transit production off in the future. Might be a decade before we'd see that, but General Motors used to be in the locomotive business. I mean, it's, you know, it's not unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Jim? Are you there, Jim?
You got to take him again.
Jim, what do you think?
I got cut off before.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Was it about the war stuff again?
Whether or not we need a whole revamping of those auto factories, and you ought to switch to making buses and mass transit vehicles, alternative energy devices.
Well, you know, around here in the Midwest or whatever, we need vehicles. We need to be able to go, you know, our own places and stuff like that. So I think that's difficult for us in the Midwest, you know, where places where we're so spread out, we need our vehicles.
Okay, let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. For those of you who want to discuss the Wisconsin situation, of course, Todd worked in Wisconsin for some time, but for those who are particularly concerned about Janesville and the future there, please call within the next few minutes, and Jim can comment on that. He'll be with us a few more minutes. We're looking at GM and Chrysler, GM declaring bankruptcy yesterday, and some hopes that maybe because of the contract worked out by the workers in Janesville and for other reasons, that plant may not sit idle. It might be part of GM's future. And we're talking about a new image, a leaner, greener, faster, smarter GM. We have yet to talk about who exactly owns GM. We've got, of course, the United States government, and we've got Canada actually holding 72.5% of the company. Together they do that. So how does it manage itself through bankruptcy? And how do you turn around the company? Oh, man, do we have a lot of phone calls. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, the email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with a philosopher and a mechanic. He's the author of Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work. Our guest has a PhD in political philosophy from the University of Chicago. He's the owner and operator of a motorcycle repair shop in Richmond, Virginia, and he'll be talking about how the move to a knowledge culture has diminished our lives and communities. Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests now. 800-486-8655 is the number, and we start our calls with Dave from Beloit. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. As always, great show. The unions have reaped what they sowed. The workers bought those giant cars. The workers had giant salaries. Those workers were buying houses they couldn't afford. And their contracts all over this country, but even pointedly in our region, have pushed an industry that was on the brink over. And the fact that we're bailing them out is ridiculous. And the fact that we would consider owning, as American citizens, this company is ridiculous. And not in the minority. I know of individuals that don't work in organized labor fields, and we look at this like if only there wasn't a bailout, they'd finally get what they deserve, which is the end of an outmoded industry.
All right, thanks for the call. I'm sure you don't feel the same way, Jim.
No, not at all, because I think unions built this country, and I think the automotive part of the unions and America, you know, built this country up to what it became before this slowdown.
Would you describe the salaries that you've made as big salaries?
Yeah, I mean we made a good living, but we gave them a good work effort for that, you know, and we can only build what they give us, you mm-hmm. know, and that's the nicest thing about Janesville and being part of it. I'm a third, almost fourth generation worker there. My grandpa was the top 10 hired in, and you know, we've built every vehicle that GM's ever gave us.
Mm-hmm.
So
you want to take this on, Todd? Is it a combination of maybe they gave them the wrong product to build? Is it do unions, do you think, bear responsibility for the cost of cars? What do you think? I guess we're trying to blame somebody.
I think it's very complex, especially compared with what the caller said. I mean, frankly, from my point of view, there's lots of blame to go around. There was a point in the late 70s, early 80s, and into the 90s when General Motors was still, you know, pretty fat and happy, even though by the late 70s, the Japanese competition had finally kind of turned things around. And they signed some pretty favorable contracts with the UAW. They also, as I mentioned earlier, bloated the dealer network, too many dealers in the United States. They had their divisions once competed with each other, and then when they got competition from outside of the U.S., didn't know how to handle it. As I said before, people were buying the types of SUVs that Jim was building just a little while ago, and they were buying them not that long ago. They were buying them from Toyota and from some other foreign manufacturers and from Ford and Chrysler as well. But things changed very quickly. The economy, of course, you can look at that and look at how manufacturing used to make up a large portion of GDP in the 1980s, and now banking makes up a larger portion than manufacturing does, and it's kind of displaced manufacturing in this country. So the question is, do you want to have a manufacturing base? I think you do, and I think, unfortunately, we've now reached the point where the government has had to help Chrysler and General Motors. That's not unprecedented either. Other countries have Ministry of Trades that are more favorable to their auto industries than we have been.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in. Please comment on recent conservative blogs and conservative radio discussion about Republican donors being selectively targeted to have their dealerships closed and whether the administration has any hand in this.
That's one of the funniest things I've heard in a long time. It's ridiculous. I think this came in connection with the Chrysler dealership closings. What Chrysler, you know, if I would bet that 90 to 95% of Chrysler dealerships, in those both being closed and those remaining open, probably lean more Republican than Democrat. And I'd also like to point out that basically, in choosing which dealers to close, Chrysler mostly targeted the ones that had not become triple dealers. They've had a program in place since 2001 to make every dealership a Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge dealership in this country, all three under one brand name, under one sign, so to speak. And that would allow Chrysler to stop building duplicate cars. The Chrysler Sebring and the Dodge Avenger, for example, are only different in that they have a different grill and a little bit of a different sheet metal. So those were the first dealers, the ones that hadn't come along and tripled. Those are the first ones targeted for closure. The next group included those that have other brands dealerships, say a Chrysler Mitsubishi or a Chrysler Toyota dealership, for example. So they targeted those that didn't fit into what Chrysler considered the best prospects going forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's strictly a business case. It's not politics.
Here's an email for you, Jim. Do you know what the ratio is of workers to retirees in the union?
Right now, we probably got, I would say, over 600,000 retirees, and we're going to be down to around 60,000 workers. So,
ooh,
it's not a pretty picture.
And tell me what that means. How are retirees being affected here?
Well, we had a retiree meeting yesterday here in Janesville, and we probably had, at least 1,500 to 2,000 retirees out of the 4,000 show up for their information part on the contract changes, and it was just unbelievable to see that many people.
I would imagine so. And what are the contract changes that are significant?
They lost their dental and their vision. Their health care turns over to the union under the VIVA fund, which we've been creating since 2005. We gave up $1 an hour raise. We gave up some cost of living gains when we had that to put into this fund to help create this fund to be taken over by the union in 2010. So right now we're hoping that the stocks pick up, that the fund is invested in, and we can supply the necessary health care for our retirees.
Mm-hmm. Jim, we wish you all the best. We'll be in touch as this story develops, and I deeply appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Jim Glass joining us the first half hour of the show, Vice President of UAW Local 95 in Janesville. Todd Lassa remains with us, Detroit editor of Motor Trend magazine. And let's go back to phone calls. Liz is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 30 years at Delphi in Oak Creek.
Mm.
And that might be an interesting story somewhere down the line.
Sure.
To Michael Moore's point, that's exactly what we were. We built bomb site navigation units starting in 1950, moved into guidance systems for Apollo, and then we also brought in, when the space program took a downturn, they brought in the powertrain control module before that.
Mm-hmm.
Born and raised in this industry, a UAW member, we're about manufacturing, and that was quite the facility to see. We also built catalytic converters in local 1866 next door.
Hmm.
So just a little food for thought, and maybe bringing in some people that lived that, and rarely do you hear about us and what that meant to the Milwaukee economy.
Right.
Not much was said, nor did people really know what we did down there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I spent my summers in Flint.
Oh, did you really?
Sure. My grandfather was at Buick, probably before it was Buick.
Huh.
As my dad and my uncle and so forth.
Yeah, send us more information. We'd be a couple areas here. It is amazing. Both Jim and our caller Liz talking about the number of family members and generations who have been in this business, which gives it a whole different feel, doesn't it? The layers of generations.
Well, it does, and frankly, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm slamming the dealers either. I mean, there are many dealers, including a lot that will be closed, who have been in business for generations. Some since the beginning of General Motors or Chrysler. Flint, Michigan was founded, basically. I mean, it was built up into almost a big city by General Motors. Delphi, Liz worked for Delphi, has been in Chapter 11 bankruptcy for the last 5 years. They were in their fifth year, I should say, of a six-month bankruptcy, which we, of course, all hope doesn't happen with General Motors. It looks like Chrysler's going to get out in time. Jim mentioned the number of retirees versus the number of people still working for General Motors, and this is the story of the United States. I mean, we now have an idea of when Social Security is going to dry up, and we, you know, people are living longer, and we have more people getting Social Security pretty soon than people paying into it. Not pretty soon, but it will happen, you know, in a number of years. And that's really the story of the United States, where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us, I don't have a full understanding of this bankruptcy and how much time GM has to turn this around and what happens with all the money. Can you give me a better understanding of what the future is, how much time they'll have to become leaner and greener? And
Yeah. Well, a good question. First of all, let me finish my thought about Delphi, is that they've finally, they're going to be getting out of bankruptcy. They've got some private investment money taking part of the company. General Motors is taking part of the company back, including a steering gear factory. I believe it's in Michigan. General Motors hopes to be out of this Chapter 11 within 60 to 90 days. And that sounds, especially if you look at what happened to Delphi, that sounds incredibly optimistic. On the other hand, it made it easier for GM management and for President Obama to say, you know, bankruptcy is the best thing for GM right now, given how quickly and relatively cleanly the Chrysler bankruptcy went. Now, Chrysler is hugely different from what the GM deal is. It's much smaller. It's always been much smaller than GM. It will be in and out within about 45 days total. It's also going to be taken over in part by Fiat. Both companies, though, will have government ownership. So you, me, and Jim, and the callers who don't like the idea of General Motors kind of becoming what some people are calling government motors, will have a part in General Motors, and that's going to be about 60% of the company. The other 12% is Canada and the province of Ontario. Part of it will go to the UAW's VEBA, not the UAW itself, but its Voluntary Employment Employee Benefit Association. Some will go to unsecured bondholders, and then, you know, a few percent here and there. Basically, the idea is that eventually, the hope is that General Motors will pull out of this relatively quickly. The government will start to sell, it will be able to start to sell stock again. If you've had stock in General Motors, it got down to about 75 cents a share a couple of days ago. Now it's worth nothing. But in a couple of years, as General Motors tries to pull itself out, it'll sell stock and kind of pay back the government loans through that.
Mm-hmm.
The target is that GM says that in a 10 million unit year in the United States, if we have 18.5% market share, we ought to be able to make a profit. That's a very low number compared to what General Motors needed to make money in the past. It relied on a much larger market share. It relied more recently on more cars being sold per year, cars and trucks. Yesterday, General Motors, all the automakers released their May sales figures. General Motors, with all the divisions it has now, is running about 20.5% market share, and the so-called seasonably adjusted rate, we were running about 10.2 million cars and trucks per year in the United States. But if you take away the divisions that will go away and just leave Chevy, Buick, GMC, and Cadillac, GM's market share was something like 16%. The other part of the hope is that by getting rid of these other brands, it'll be able to concentrate more marketing money on the brands that remain. And, for example, people who were buying Pontiacs, and there weren't that many of them, but it did, you know, raise the market share beyond that 18.5%. The hope is that those buyers will migrate mostly to Chevy and maybe a few to Buick.
Mm-hmm.
So that, kind of in a nutshell, is where it's trying to head in the U.S. market.
And the biggest market share now is what?
General Motors still has the biggest market share.
Do they?
It still leads Ford Motor Company and Toyota in market share. And Toyota's somewhere around, I believe, 16.5%. Ford is a couple of points lower. I'm sorry. Let me reverse that. Ford was actually ahead of Toyota yesterday. They're both in the 15-16% area, roughly, maybe a little bit lower. I think I've probably said on your show before that the future market in the United States will be much like what Western Europe has become, and that is that no automaker will have more than about 18% share. So I think in the future you're going to see three large automakers that will each have about 18% market share, and if GM is successful, it will be one of them. Toyota will be another. And Ford Motor Company, which is looking pretty good recently, will be the third. Chrysler, Fiat, mostly Fiat, will probably be around the 10 or 11% range, which is, you know, somewhere in the same area as Honda, for example. Nissan and some of the other makes all in the 8, 9, 10% range.
Let's go to Ralph next from Milwaukee. Hi, Ralph.
Hello. I have a couple of things I'd like to say. Mostly, the first is divide and conquer. The banking industry, as you had mentioned earlier, has taken over the gross domestic product or the gross national product as far as what we are manufacturing, as it were, even though it's not really manufacturing, it's just moving paper. And divide and conquer comes from the idea that as opposed to addressing these problems as they were, we'd rather nitpick with individuals like ourselves instead of these corporations that are pretty much hijacking our resources and our talent and our ideas and shipping it overseas for cheaper labor. And why should we be upset about them doing that when it makes perfect business sense? And also, why should we be upset with union workers who are trying to make a living, who are trying to support families, when that's all anyone else is trying to do? I mean, it's not like the executives of these car companies need to support, or maybe they do need to support millions of families. But either way it goes, it's like we take one problem and we'd rather dissect it into who's wrong, as opposed to like saying, well, maybe this entire system is wrong.
Okay, Todd.
Well, you know, he's right in that as I mentioned earlier, if you look at foreign automakers, Japan has a Ministry of Trade that is very favorable to Toyota, Nissan, Honda, and has helped out in the past, including connections in banking. Toyota is very strong now. Even Toyota has seen the kinds of cut in production and has seen sales just plummet just in the last year, both here in the United States and in Japan. And they're tied in a bit more with their government. It's funny, last week Bob Lutz, who is the outgoing, he's the retiring vice chairman of General Motors, and was in charge of product development, and I think he was speaking his mind, as he usually does, but especially because he is retiring, he's leaving GM at the end of the year. He said that he would like to see that sort of Ministry of Trade, including an automotive component in this country that would be the match of what Western Europe and Japan has. And Bob Lutz, I wrote in a blog post at the Motor City Blogman at MotorTrend.com, I wrote how he is perhaps one of the most conservative people I know, and I know a lot of pretty politically conservative people. And he, last week, to my surprise, actually, to my astonishment, had some praise for the Obama administration's automotive task force. He agreed with what Obama said, that the government does not want to take over and run General Motors or Chrysler, that this is a way to try to kind of prop up manufacturing again and bring it back. And he actually said that he was pretty pleased with the way that negotiations and talks with the task force worked in the last several months.
Thanks very much, Ralph, for the call. Jeff is next from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
I was calling to find out if they had any idea if GM would be building something like the EV1, the car, the electric car that they produced in the early 90s, if that was going to be coming back, or if anybody knew.
Yeah, well, there's a car that would be, I guess, the next idea, the next version of that beyond that, and that's called the Chevrolet Volt, and that is due to come out in the late 2010 as a 2011 model. Now, what the Volt is what they call an extended range electric car. It's going to have batteries that will be made into a battery pack here in the United States and installed into the car, and there will be a small 1.4-liter gasoline engine that will recharge the batteries when the batteries run down. Because the problem with the EV1, one of the problems with the EV1 is that, for one thing, it was a very small car. Try to make it as light as possible to give it extended range. The best range it had might have been 75 miles in a day, and then you had to recharge it for 8 hours. But if you include hills and traffic and wind and all kinds of other variables, 75 miles is probably very optimistic. So the idea is that the Chevy Volt will run 40 miles on pure electric, and when the batteries start to run down, the gasoline engine, which will use not much gas, but will use some gas, of course, will recharge those batteries.
Hmm. What do you think of Fritz Henderson?
That's a good question. I think he's trying to do a really good job. He's very much a protege of Rick Wagner, who although Rick had his foibles, certainly he understood what he did not know about the auto industry, and that is that Wagner came from the finance side, and he's the guy who brought in Bob Lutz to kind of get the product back in order. And the product is getting much better in the last few years. Cars like the Cadillac CTS, the Chevy Malibu, show that General Motors can build a world-class car, you know, that can compete with the Europeans or the Asians. And, you know, I think Henderson is going to do a lot of the type of things that Wagner would have done had he remained. On the other hand, it's very clear that the administration wanted to get rid of Rick Wagner and replace him with Henderson, because Henderson was more receptive to using bankruptcy as a last resort, and that's what he did. And of course, in the bankruptcy, they're using something called the Section 363 bankruptcy, which will divide the company into new assets and old assets, good assets and bad assets, and it basically sheds the bad assets, the heavy debt, and brings this new, smaller, leaner company into the future. Mm-hmm. That said, there needs to be some really fresh management at or near the top of General Motors, and there need to be good car people who understand cars and what makes a good car.
That would be a great idea.
there are people there. I mean, the thing about General Motors and its competitors, General Motors has an incredible amount of talent. And one thing that happened in the last few years with under Rick Wagner and especially under Bob Lutz is that the design staff changed. And I think you can see that if you look at some of the recent designs, how good the cars look now compared with just 5 or 10 years ago. And so it's just a matter of letting some of those people who are, you know, maybe mid-level management or even lower do their thing and do it well.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Thanks very much, Jeffrey. Your caller number is 800-486-8655. And our guest is Todd Lassa, Detroit editor of Motor Trend magazine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Wednesday, the author of Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work. Should be a really good conversation. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Greg from Watertown is next. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Kathleen and guests. You know, I think most of our problems that we're experiencing, not only with the auto industry, but across the gambit of our economic collapses, our reductionist thinking. We tend to always constrain things into economic terms only, not understanding that there are ecological constraints that oftentimes lie at the bottom of these types of things, like, for instance, peak oil and the scarcity of oil, which is only going to get worse in the future. And I think what we need to do is look at these problems that we're facing from a more holistic viewpoint and a systems thinking perspective, where we understand the ecological constraints that really are going to dictate what we can and can't do. And let me give you a couple examples. We're talking about fuel cell vehicles, but there's not enough platinum on the face of the earth to even power the American fleet. We talk about high quality lithium ion batteries, but there's not enough lithium. The only lithium that we have on the face of the earth worth mining at this point is coming from Bolivia. And I think if we were to look at these things from a real holistic viewpoint where you understand the ecological constraints and you understand the social constraints, I'm all for living wages and things of that nature. And then certainly you need to understand the economic constraints. But so far in our society, we seem to only be concerned about the economics of the situation. And here's my partial solution to this. I think we should really start to investigate ethanol production, and not necessarily from corn, but there are many, many crops out there that can produce ethanol. And we focus on corn because our industry is set up to do corn, and everything is set up to subsidize corn and to keep that market afloat. But there are other crops, and I don't want to go there because I want to make a different point, and that is that if we went to pure ethanol engines, if you take a gas engine, it's like 23% efficient. It pollutes a lot. You take a diesel engine, that can get up to 30% efficiency in extracting energy from heat. But if you go to pure ethanol, you can get up to 45% efficiencies, and they burn perfectly clean. Ethanol is nothing but carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And when you burn it, it is perfectly clean. It's the other things that add pollutants to the air. If you grow that in a permaculturally holistic way, that ethanol, you can provide jobs, you can have, you can really solve a lot of the problems that we're looking at, and you can produce a product that is going to be worlds ahead of everything. It's what they're doing in Sweden. The Indy cars use these types of engines, but we get locked into these perspectives of gasoline because we're not willing to take this holistic viewpoint. And
okay, Greg, thank you very much. Great points.
If I may, he's right that I think maybe a sugar-based ethanol might be in our future, and General Motors, for one, and other automakers have been working with several alternative fuel companies to try to develop fuels from biodiesels, for example, sugar-based ethanols, even using garbage to make a sort of fuel. I think the fuel cell idea probably is, if it's not dead, it's going to be on the back burner for a long time. The force working against this, of course, are the oil companies, which have been making, frankly, huge profits in the last few years, record profits at ExxonMobil, as General Motors and Ford and Chrysler lose all sorts of money. So you have to look at it from that point of view, too. Big oil has had a big say in this country and globally for many years.
Let's go to one more call. Scott from River Falls. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Boy, that last guy, I really liked what he had to say. But I was going to look back in the history a little bit and what the problems we're looking at now. I was looking back in the heyday of GM when they sold 17 million units earlier in the decade, yet they posted a $10 billion loss for that year. And, I think that's got to do with the legacy costs. And a little more research revealed that after this restructuring, GM is actually going to have closer to 40,000 employees who are going to have to take care of over 1 million retirees and family members. And that, to me, just doesn't seem sustainable. But they've got the burden of health care costs where the Toyota manufacturers don't seem to have that burden. And I'm wondering if you've got any solutions to offer to those
good
two
points.
Problems.
Good points.
Well, 17 million was the total industry when they were a few years ago. That was the top for the entire industry in the United States. Toyota has huge sums of cash from which to live off of as the auto industry kind of readjusts to this much lower level. That's true. GM did go through some bad financial times. There was nearly a bankruptcy back in 1992, not that long ago. Your caller is right. There were those legacy costs. There will be a reduction of 40,000 blue collar and 22,000 white collar, if my memory serves, in the coming reorganization. Currently, there's about 235,000 GM employees. That's down from about 619,000 in 1979. So that's changed quite a bit. Toyota has just basically it has been able to make money on small cars, on all sorts of cars. General Motors, especially, and also Ford and Chrysler, have only been able to make money on big cars and SUVs and trucks. Small cars, we're basically loss leaders for them and have always been. GM claims that it's going to be able to make money on its upcoming Chevy Cruze. It had better. Otherwise, it will not survive the next decade.
Mm. Thank you so much, Todd. You're so knowledgeable about all of this, and it's really it's a complicated issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hugely complicated. I could spend hours more, and I know you don't have the time. And if I may, just a personal note real quickly, say happy birthday to my niece Betsy back in Wauwatosa. I know she's listening.
Do you want to sing?
No. Okay. You don't want to hear me sing.
Thank you, Todd, very much. Todd Lazar, our guest, Detroit editor of Motor Trend magazine. He did spend some time actually working for the Milwaukee Sentinel back in the 80s. Been reporting on and analyzing the auto business for nearly 13 years now. He's Detroit editor for Motor Trend. And you can go to motortrend.com and read a lot of his writings about the what's going on in the auto industry. It's quite a time to have his job. Thanks to Robert Schroeder for producing this program. It was a good show, Robin. Thanks for his on-air production as well. For all of your calls, we also thank you. We also want to thank Jim Glass, Vice President of the UAW Local 95 in Janesville, for being with us. News is coming up. We have another hour to go, so stick around. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.